Today on Doomed!
Matt Brunig, the founder and president of the People's Policy Project, joins us to answer the question, why should healthcare be completely free? How women's health and universal healthcare are politically entwined, the insane scheme which healthcare companies have rigged that decides your healthcare subsidy, breaking down the new United States of Care Group, and the attack on the Medicare for All movement, and a look at a new healthcare plan from the Center for American Progress. All that and much, much more on today's extremely educational episode of Doomed with Matt Binder. So here's the deal, everyone. I have finally succumbed to the dark, all-encompassing podcast monetizing entity known as Patreon. I know, every podcast you listen to is doing it, but here's the deal. Succumb to peer pressure. But no, really. This weekly episode of Doomed is free. It has been free for months now when I started the podcast, and it will remain free, always. And if you want to, and can support this show, and want extra weekly content, head on over to legionofdoomed.com. That's right, Legion of Doomed. That's what I'm calling all of you. You don't get a decision in this part. Anyway, I'm asking for $5 a month. That's $1.25 a week. That's one quarter each weekday. That's right, I'm doing some math here. And in return, you get bonus content. Or you can even give less than $5. Or nothing at all. It's totally up to you. And you'll continue getting this fantastic, so I've been told, weekly show, as usual, absolutely free. All right, without any further ado, joining us now on the show is Matt Brunig, the founder and president of the People's Policy Project. Matt, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, no problem. And did I say your last name right? I mean, I feel like I did, but maybe I didn't.
Yeah, it's very phonetic. You just straightforward, like you did.
Perfect, perfect. All right, now I feel like we scheduled this interview, and I feel like you helped me out here a little bit even by saying, you know what, I'm going to provide him with even more content by writing two more pieces for the People's Policy Project that's in this wheelhouse since we scheduled this interview.
Yeah.
So we're going to talk about it all today. And for people who are tuning in, what we're going to tell and weren't involved in our one-on-one DMs, which I guess is everybody other than you and me, today we're going to be talking about healthcare and the United States of America. Fun.
Yeah. No, it's going to be great.
Yeah, for sure.
Great system.
So you've had a number of in-depth looks recently at, I'm going to tell everyone your domain, how to go to your website, peoplespolicyproject.org. And for me, universal healthcare has always been a major issue. In fact, if we want to talk about elections, in 2008, during the Democratic primary, I was in fact a Hillary Clinton supporter at first because of her support of universal healthcare. I mean, at the time, her and Obama, that to me at least was the defining difference. There really wasn't much else. So that's how I was a 2008 Hillary Clinton supporter at first.
Well, there you go. At least you were consistent.
Yes. And now, you know, with Donald Trump as the president and the Republican Party in power, I feel like, you know, with people literally putting their bodies on the line, getting arrested, protesting, disabled people literally being carried out in their wheelchairs by, you know, the Capitol Police and, you know, people calling from their offices, their representatives, multiple times a day, just so basically they can save the shitty healthcare they have via Obamacare. I think now the country might finally be in a place. I mean, we always were health-wise, financial-wise, but maybe for the first time politically, we're somewhere where universal healthcare or Medicare for All has never been, you know, more viable.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, if you look at the polling, the support has gone up and up and up recently. And, you know, that's probably been a function of Bernie Sanders being very popular and being behind it. And also a lot of the, I don't know, centrist opposition to it it's still there, but they've they've kind of dialed it down a little bit. They're not, you know, throwing bombs at it in the same way as they used to. So it's they kind of cleared the field a little bit, and they don't have an alternative to, you know, our current system to make it better, really. Not one that they all agree on. And so, you know, we're kind of Medicare for All is sort of the default player of how to improve things going forward.
Right, right. And it is really interesting to see just how quickly the mood changed on this.
Yeah, I mean, you know, well, it's, you know, I think it shows some of the, a lot of the centrist theorizing about how politics works, where people have these kind of deeply held policy positions, and you have to navigate through the center of those factions and the center of the distribution of political thought in the country, that's just completely nonsense, that's not how people form political ideas at all. That if you get a really, you know, interesting, inspiring idea supported by an interesting, inspiring politician, you can really move the needle really fast on certain ideas. And this has been a great test case for that theory, and it seems to have proven itself.
Right, right. And, you know, in some ways, actually, it sort of shows, too. I mean, this actually happened quicker than I thought, too. I was always concerned, like, you know, Obamacare obviously was better than what we had before. But, you know, Obamacare still is not the solution we should all be happy to end with. So it was always interesting to me that, you know, I was very worried for a while that Obamacare is good, better than what we had before, but being that Obama is such a popular president and him being so connected to, I mean, it's literally called Obamacare, that, you know, his connection to the Affordable Care Act would make moving on to the next better thing even harder. And I feel like as soon as his presidency came to an end and Trump came into office, that sort of thing that was, I would say, at its most prevalent probably during the Democratic primary in 2016, yeah, I would say that is completely gone. That worry that Obama's connection to Obamacare would make the Democratic base's support for Obamacare supersede any sort of support for something better.
Yeah, no, I think during the primary, I was a little frustrated, I guess, by the way people positioned Obamacare as being intimately connected to Obama's legacy in such a way that if you were to oppose it or say you didn't like it, that was a direct insult to Obama, who also, by the way, is our first black president, and so on and so forth. Like, it was almost like criticizing Obamacare made you kind of a tad bit racist or something like that. That was as far as some of them were taking it, you know, because it was so connected. This was his signature achievement, and if we were to just toss it for something else, then, you know, my God, what an insult that would be to such a historic presidency. But yeah, as he's faded from the light, you don't see that that position being pushed as much anymore.
The weird thing to me too is, like, even if you want to, you know, preserve that Obama legacy in healthcare, I mean, I could argue that without Obamacare, especially the, you know, the Medicaid expansion and people who have been able to benefit from that, seeing where this could all go, I would say maybe even Medicare for All or universal healthcare or single payer, whatever the next step is, I would say that might not have been possible when it ends up happening.
Yeah, I mean, that's one way you could square the circle if you were, you know, if you really wanted to go to single payer and you wanted to do it in a way that didn't seem like a repudiation of what Obama accomplished. You could easily tell a story where this is a step on the path to single payer. It's not, you know, it may not be the most correct story, but it's a plausible story in the same way that Medicare initially was a step, and then the introduction of Medicaid and the introduction of CHIP, and slowly but surely we're, you know, chipping away at private health insurance, and Obamacare did that a little bit, especially with the Medicare expansion. you could tell that story of like inevitable historical progress, even use, you know, that the quote that Obama liked about the arc of history bending towards justice and blah, blah, blah. You could do that if you wanted to, and I don't see any reason not to do that if it's like helpful rhetorically. But that was not how the center wanted to play it. They wanted to play it as this is a negation of Obama.
Right. And I'm open to them spinning the story and telling whatever tale they'd like to if we end up getting there as soon as possible. I mean, I've always been someone who thought, you know, I mean, this is not the same sort of Trump now, but that joke for a while where, you know, if you tell Trump that Medicaid for all would make him the deal maker king, he'd be for it. And if that was the case, if Donald Trump tricking Donald Trump into somehow backing universal health care, and he's even like put other like countries on a pedestal when talking about their health care without realizing that those countries he's talking about have a universal health care model. So, you know, I'm all for the story. Tell whatever story you need to. Give the props to whoever you want to, as long as we get there.
Yeah, no, I have no ownership over it. You know, whoever wants to take it, they should take it, you know, as long as they get it done.
Right. So let's get to the I'm trying to figure out which one of your posts at People's Policy Project we could get to first. You know what? Let's start with this. I think this is the perfect jump off spot. So you recently wrote for People's Policy Project, "Why Should Healthcare Be Completely Free?" And you go over it. Take us through it.
Yeah, so I just wanted to make the kind of basic sort of philosophical case for why people say healthcare should be free. And there is this philosophical school of thought, kind of give the basic philosophical position or one of the basic philosophical positions for why healthcare should be completely free, meaning that you're not having to pay for specific procedures based on what health procedures you need, but that everyone pays in and everyone gets, and there's no cost sharing or anything like that. And I use the kind of basic egalitarian sort of philosophical premise, which is that, you know, what egalitarians think is that people should be essentially equal in most areas of their life, especially areas of their life that they don't have control over. And so health is a classical category of that. Most people, they don't get to control how sick they are. They don't get to control if they get injured, if they contract some kind of disease. And so the idea behind free healthcare is to say, let's just level that out so that if you and me are basically the same, but I contract an illness and you don't, I shouldn't have to give up things in my life in order to cover that illness. We'll all just cover it collectively. That way we'll be otherwise equal. And so that's the case for why people shouldn't have to pay out of pocket for medication or out of pocket for medical procedures and stuff like that.
Right. So you believe, and I mean, it's the, not even you believe, you, the egalitarian case, you know, you have a great example in your analysis of it, is that, you know, a diabetic person and a non-diabetic person should be able to have, you know, materially equivalent lives, and the cost of their medication or treatment should not really have a bearing on what they're able to afford and do.
Right, exactly, right? I mean, we might want to say that we want to allow certain kinds of inequalities in the country, meaning that, you know, maybe there's going to be a pay scale so that, you know, people who are just starting out in an industry are paid a little bit less than people who have experience and that kind of thing. But we don't want to say that people should be unequal based on what health ailments they happen to have. So two otherwise identical people who have similar, you know, education, similar jobs, just because one of them has diabetes or one of them breaks their leg, they shouldn't have to, you know, live a worse life, live in worse neighborhoods, live in worse, I should say, like housing, live in worse, have worse food, not be able to socialize, go out and, you know, get a drink. And, you know, we want them to be equal, to be included equally in society with everyone else, not be kind of hidden away living a really kind of poor life because they're having to pay for medicine.
Right. Of course. And what would possibly be the case against this and for cost sharing.
Yeah, so there isn't, if you buy the egalitarian premise, there's not a strong case for cost sharing. The case people will provide is a more utilitarian calculus, where they'll say, look, if you let people go to the doctor for free or get medicine for free, they're going to overutilize it. So, you know, if the doctor is free, you could just go, and so you're just going to go all the time. And, you know, that's probably not true for most people. You know, you might find an occasional person who does something like that. I think they've had problems from time to time in other systems where elderly people who are lonely will go to the doctor frequently. And so, you know, you have to deal with those sort of weird issues. But for the most part, that's not an issue, and that's not where people are being asked to share costs, right? So, like, right. If I'm diagnosed with diabetes and I have to get insulin, why would I have to do a copay for insulin? I'm not going to just use tons and tons of insulin. I'm just going to use the insulin I need. If I use too much, I'll die. If I use too little, I'll die. There's no rationale for it. So the cost sharing, the argument for cost sharing would only, if you believed it, would only apply to certain things, like the first time you go to visit the doctor for something you're sick about. Maybe you want to say you have to pay $10 for that or something like that. But then every subsequent visit for that same ailment, it doesn't make sense to say you need to pay for that, because you're just following the doctor's advice at that point, getting, you know, subsequent treatments, and you want people to do that.
Right.
The same for if you get prescribed a medication. I go to the doctor and they say you need an antibiotic. You want people to get the antibiotic. You don't want them going, oh, I don't know, is it too expensive? Like, that's not the calculation you want people to make. So to the extent that there's any argument for cost sharing, it really only applies to non-essential services, so voluntary surgeries that you don't really need, and kind of initial visits to the doctor. Everything else, it doesn't make sense to require cost sharing, but that's where they want. But they apply cost sharing across the board, copays and deductibles and all the rest of it.
Is there any like belief though, even that, like, you just brought up, like, surgeries, I guess, that are not necessary. Like, is there any sort of like movement out there where, like, you know, like voluntary, like cosmetic Botox or whatever should be free? Like, I don't even think that, like, how is that even an issue? Like, how could that even be an argument against this? I don't think there's anyone who thinks that if that's just for, you know, voluntary cosmetic purposes, that should be free of cost.
Yeah, well, it's more for these kind of borderline things. So, like, maybe a knee replacement or something where I don't need a knee replacement in the sense that I can shuffle along and maybe I'm not even in pain, but I just, you know, I can't run or I can't. You know, I'm a little bit limited, but I can basically, I'm fine. It's stuff like that. That's where you'll get some, like, okay, well, maybe we'll make you pay $100, you know, to chip in for that because it's not essential, that sort of thing.
I mean, for me, I didn't even consider something like that because to me, that sounds pretty essential to me. I mean, your quality of life is certainly affected quite dramatically, I would say, by, you know, just shuffling around.
Yeah, well, it just depends. I mean, some of it is more severe or less severe than other things, but that's sort of, it's on that spectrum, and you can kind of, you have to think of some other examples, perhaps, that would make more sense.
I hear that that ambulance in your background, and I'm thinking to myself, well, someone's about to pay a couple $100 just for that ride.
Yeah, and it's probably a fire engine, but it's the same. Well, I guess no fire, you know, you don't really pay for fire, do you?
Well, actually, some places I remember reading, if you don't pay, like, the specific fire tax, which is voluntary to pay, you know, your house burns down and the fire department just shows up and makes sure that it doesn't move on to any of the houses that did pay the firefighter tax. And they just let your house burn down.
I remember some stories of that happening. It seems really...
And they just stand there and watch your house burn down, like defending the houses around it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, we got to set an example for everyone else, make sure they realize that you can't cheat. You know, you got to pay.
That's the egalitarian case against cost sharing. I just can't, you know, I'm just thinking in my head, you know, like all the things I would take advantage of, or I do when there's like, you know, free ice cream day or something like that. And I go down to as many Carvel's or Baskin Robbins and get as many scoops of free ice cream as I can. I can't think of any like scenario where I'd be like, I'm going to screw over some doctors today and see as many as I can. Like,
yeah,
I don't
know. Going to the doctor is not a pleasant experience for most people. So it's not something you would do just because it's free, in the same way that you might go to an amusement park or eat a delicious dinner or something. That's not how people regard going to the doctor generally.
Yeah,
with some exceptions, like I said, old people who are lonely, it's one of those weird cases where you do see stuff like that.
And you know what? If they didn't have Medicare, I bet they would find somewhere else to talk to people.
That's true, yeah. Or, you know, maybe we could solve it by providing, you know, I don't know, community centers that elderly people can go to and chat with one another.
Come on, Matt. You're making too much sense here. Come on. That would just be the obvious thing to do. Now, in this why should healthcare be completely free post, you make a great case. To me, it's sort of it's not the same, but it's like the case of comparing healthcare with means testing. You know, like for example, should we, in our search for free public education, you know, every child, no matter what their socioeconomic places in the world, in this country, they can get a free public school elementary school education and high school. Yeah. And in the movement for free public universities and colleges, there's this blowback from the center about not giving this free education to people over a certain, you know, if their family makes over $250,000 or whatever. And, you know, when you means test like that and not provide it for all, the at the very least, the Republican or right wing or conservative attacks on it makes it a lot easier for them. It just makes it a lot easier for them because they're able to say, you know, this is only for specific people. We're going to fight against this. You know, their donor class isn't benefiting from this, so why should they care? But you don't, obviously you don't see anyone calling for the rollback of free public, well, not anyone, but you don't see the same sort of rollback fight for, you know, free public schooling like we do for the movement to give free public education in college and university. So in your post, you use the case of birth control as sort of a comparison to that.
Yeah, so the reason I used birth control is because the centrists who tend to like the idea of cost sharing, like deductibles and co-pays and that sort of thing, they have over the last 6 years written a lot of material about why there should be no cost sharing for birth control, which was a part of Obamacare. Obamacare made it to where you could get birth control for free if you were insured, and Republicans have been trying to roll that back. And as part of that struggle, you know, every liberal institution, the Center for American Progress, the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, Vox, New York Times, Washington Post, all of these sort of centrist organs, they have written piece after piece after piece about why requiring cost sharing for birth control would be unfair, dangerous to people's health, would ruin people financially, etc. And, you know, in a kind of defeat them by their own logic jujitsu, I thought, well, let's take that example, since you guys agree in that case that there shouldn't be cost sharing for birth control, and just take those arguments and apply them to everything else in the healthcare sector. If there shouldn't be cost sharing for birth control, then surely there shouldn't be cost sharing for insulin or dialysis or chemotherapy or, you know, these other things, which are certainly as, you know, necessary as birth control. One might argue even more necessary, since you will die without dialysis. And so that was just the basic idea, is to say, oh, you guys seem to get this in the birth control area. Let's just apply it to everything else and see how they deal with that contradiction in their own advocacy. That was sort of the hope of raising that point.
And the interesting thing to me is this would even benefit, women's healthcare rights even more so, because the right is able to focus their attacks on this free birth control thing. And the reason they're able to focus on this is obviously because they're obsessed with controlling women's bodies. But the reason they're able to obsess about that is because this is the one thing being provided for free.
That's true. I mean, I hadn't considered that in the post. But yeah, if you single out only birth control is going to be without cost sharing, then it becomes like, why this? What's going on? It sort of sticks out. It becomes the exception.
And it bolsters their attacks.
Right. Whereas if you're like, all medication is going to be without cost sharing, and all treatments for the most part are going to be without cost sharing, then it becomes the opposite situation, where if you were to take birth control out of it, it would be weird. It'd be like, why that? And so the weirdness is on the wrong foot, because we've only singled that out, whereas if we had all medicine covered, to not provide birth control would single that out in the other direction. So that's an interesting point.
Why, thank you. No, but it's true though. I mean, it's almost like it gives ammunition to these guys to just go after this. And it's just a battle that doesn't need to be had. Like, if this was just one of the many, many, many medications that are provided to people at no cost, then there would be no point in them going after this specifically, because why would it be weird? Why would it be wrong to give this out for free? We do it for everything else.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. And especially since, you know, the conservative position on this is that, you know, the reason liberals really push this is because they're trying to fight some kind of cultural battle. And that's why they've singled out and are trying to push birth control and whatever. And yeah, if that is in fact the only medication or one of the few that you're doing this on, that kind of validates, or seems to in their mind to validate, the idea that this is just a cultural proxy battle that you guys are fighting through your medical reform. Whereas if it was like, no, we just do all medications like this, then that case becomes a lot weaker, and it becomes a lot harder for them to mobilize people around the idea that that liberals are leveraging health reform to fight a culture war against, you know, people who are, you know, super conservative, religious conservatives.
Now the centrists would hear this discussion we're having about, I guess, all medication being equal in terms of its cost, and say, that's right, we should also charge for birth control.
No, but don't. I mean, that's the interesting thing about it.
Yeah, but so what we're saying here is all the other medications should be able to hop aboard the birth control train and also be cost-free.
Right, exactly. And that's why I brought up the birth control case, because there's no chance, because of all the commitments that they've made over the last few years, that they're going to go back and say, oh, okay, well, maybe we should have cost sharing for birth control as well. They're not going to do that. And so the only way forward, then, if you point out this contradiction and you want to resolve it, is to say, well, bring in all the other medicines as well.
Right. And there shouldn't be any going, like, there shouldn't be any going back on this. Like, this is where we're at, and it should be where we're at forever. Birth control should be free. We should also make sure everything else is.
Right. If it's a prescribed medication that's medically necessary, people be asked to make a decision about, is this worth the price? That's why you have prices, is to cause people to make these sort of trade-offs, is to calculate, is this worth it? Should I buy $5 of chicken, or should I buy $4 of beef, which, you know, for a pound or whatever? Like, it's those sort of comparisons you're asking people to make. With medicine, we just want you to take it. We want you to get better. We don't want you to be sick. And so cost sharing doesn't make sense given how we want people to interact with medicine, which is not to treat it as something they could buy or could not buy depending on the price, but something that is necessary and they need to take for themselves, for their family, for people around them who they could get sick, you know, the whole thing.
Right. So on the People's Policy Project, you published this work by John Walker, who said that Obamacare works better with monopoly insurers. Can you take us through that?
Yeah, so this gets a little bit wonky, but here's the situation. If you're in an Obamacare exchange, which means you don't get your insurance from your employer, you're not on Medicaid, but you have to go in to one of those websites where you have to shop and pick a silver plan or a gold plan or a bronze plan, if you're in that situation, okay, that works is if you have an income below 400% of the poverty line, you get a means-tested, refundable tax credit to pay for your insurance. Already, the eyes are kind of glazing over, but you can kind of think about it as this is how much the government's going to chip in to help you pay your premium.
Right.
How is that subsidy set? When the government says, we're going to help you pay for some of the premium, how do they decide how much they're going to help you pay? And the answer is, they go into your particular market. Every county in the country has its own health care market. You go into that market, you find the second lowest cost silver plan. So you, all the silver plans that are being sold on that exchange, you get the second lowest cost one. You take that premium that they're charging people and you base the subsidy on that. Okay? And you don't need to go too deep in the formula, but it's pegged to that second lowest cost silver plan. Now, in competitive markets, the difference between the lowest cost silver plan and the second lowest cost silver plan, the difference in price between those two is very small. Like you would expect, prices converge in competitive markets. But when you have a non-competitive market, when you have a county where there's only one insurer, which there are tons of counties in this country with only one insurer, you go to the exchange, there's only one company selling things. When you're in a market with only one insurer, they know that they're going to offer both the lowest cost silver plan and the second lowest cost silver plan. They know they're going to offer both because there's no one else who's going to offer anything. So what they will do, what they can do, and what they do. They game it. They will publish, they will offer a cheap silver plan for, say, $500. Then they'll offer the second silver plan for, you know, $700. Knowing that the subsidy is going to be based on that $700 plan. You're not going to buy the $700 plan. You're going to take your subsidy that's based on the $700 plan, and you're going to buy the $500 plan. Everyone's going to do that in that market. Why else? It's a silver plan. Why would you buy a more expensive silver plan? Does it make sense?
The second you brought up that they take the they base it on the cost of the second lowest silver plan, the second you said that, I thought to myself, oh, well, this is so obvious to anyone that there's a flaw in this system because this is how they'll game it. This is how they'll rig the system in their favor.
Yeah, I mean, it only takes about 2 minutes when you start thinking about it where you realize, oh man, these single insurer markets, there's a huge potential here for gaming. I think one of the problems is when they were designing the law, I think they assumed two things. One, that there would be a lot of competition in all these markets, that there would be insurers everywhere wanting to offer plans. That has not materialized. And second, remember at the very beginning of a process, there was going to be a public option. So there should be a government option in all of these markets, which would then make it impossible for you to game this system. But that got stripped out. But when that got stripped out, I guess they didn't realize, well, wait a minute, our subsidy doesn't work anymore. That still stays in the bill. And, you know, here we are. So, Yeah, I mean, you know, through a comedy of errors, we're in this weird situation where these single insurer markets are able to game and drive up subsidies for their customers, which actually helps their customers, but, you know, in a way that is totally unintended by the way the law is designed.
Right. And I got to say, that was a very easy to digest explanation of this wonkery. It was like, it was great. I don't see how anyone could not understand what's going on here and see this as just one of the other multitude, just one more notch on the belt of the many reasons why Obamacare needs to go away once we get single-payer universal health care.
Yeah, no, when I was editing the piece and I fully came to understand what he had found, that was my position was, you know, just narrowly on what he found, you're kind of like, that's interesting, that's neat, I see how that works. It's kind of unfortunate, I guess, in some ways. But then on a broader level, you're like, oh my God, this system is just a disaster. Like, everything about the system is so complicated. There's so many little problems that have arrived from basically, you know, approaching this from the technocratic, you know, way that liberals do, where it's like, we're going to have 1,000 different bells and whistles. Let's peg it to the second lowest cost silver plan with means tested tax credits. And, you know, let's get all the economists' best, you know, ideas and cram it in here. And it's like, yeah, the thing that you created at the end of the day is like, you know, a house of cards, and it's so complicated. Something, you know, happens that you didn't expect, and the whole thing kind of collapses.
And also, what you got to keep in the back of your mind too, when you're just looking at all this and saying like, what the fuck, you got to think to yourself at the same time, and this is better than what we had.
Yeah. No, before you, if you were in this situation and you didn't have employer care, you know, you would try to get individual insurance, and it would be, one, for most people, totally unaffordable. And then for other people, you know, if you had a pre-existing condition, they wouldn't let you get it, or maybe they'd let you get it, and then the first time you made a claim, they would deny your claim because you had a pre-existing condition. I mean, it was impossible if you didn't have employer care or Medicaid to basically get any kind of insurance. So it's an improvement in a very small way.
Right. And, you know, I guess the next step here won't be in our health. The next step in our healthcare industry, where we take healthcare in the United States of America next, I hope, and I'm going to assume that we won't, but I hope it won't be coming from a organization called the United States of Care.
Yes, yes. This organization, Andy Slavitt, leads the organization, or he seems to be the public face of it. It was created, I guess, a month ago or 2 months ago.
Now, for people who don't know who Andy Slavitt is, I would say most, the average American who doesn't even need to really be plugged into this political bubble that we live in, I would say the average person probably knows him best as, and it's not even actually for his direct work under the Obama administration. I would say it's probably more so as one of the main guys online who is telling you what to do and when to do it in terms of the actions you needed to take to save Obamacare in early to mid 2017.
Yes, yes. Yeah, that's been his latest role, is as a kind of activist poster telling you to contact your congressperson and save Obamacare. Before that, he was an administrator who helped, you know, Obamacare get off the ground. So, you know, I mean, he has credibility on this topic, but he's managed to put together an organization that the United States of Care, that has no clear anything, has no plan, no proposal, has very vague principles for healthcare, that seems to be, if you read between the lines and you look at who the board members are, that looks like it's getting ready to kneecap single payer from the center.
So they basically, it seems like their slogan is, let's change the conversation and put healthcare over politics, which is funny to me because that makes it sound like they are involved with changing the conversation. And I'm going to say, and I think I'm very accurate in saying it, they're both late and wrong about this conversation.
Yeah, well, and you know, if you want to change the conversation, it's a really bizarre. I mean, imagine
it's already been changed. The conversation's already been changed. We've been on this new conversation. Yeah.
Like the way conversation changes work, you know, if you've ever had a conversation with a human being, is, oh, I don't like this topic, or this topic is dying, or I think we should go in another direction. You just bring up a new topic. You bring up a new idea. You say something else. You don't go, hey, let's change the conversation. And then off to nothing. Like, what do you, okay, change the conversation to what? What do
that well, they say put healthcare over politics, but it's quite clear from their ideas here. It's just to bog down that put healthcare over politics conversation. And actually, their conversation is, let's steer the conversation back to politics in your healthcare.
Yeah, that's the funny thing. The slogan is healthcare over politics, but then principle number three is policies that try to achieve, you know, healthcare goals must win the political support needed to ensure long-term stability, which is to say healthcare policies need to be under politics, not over politics.
Right. Let's go through those three guiding principles they have as an organization.
Yeah, this is great. So, you know, there's three of them. There's, but two of them are identical to one another. So obviously someone in the copy editing phase was like, we need at least three. People love threes. So the first one is, every American should have an affordable, regular source of care for themselves and their families. That's, you know, that sounds fine as far as things go.
There's that word though. Yeah, affordable.
Affordable is, you know, they're elbowing you towards accepting co-payments and deductibles that are means tested and that sort of thing.
I have my own. I have my own like theory here. Where like you know, like in like I guess the marketing world, they have a what's called an A/B testing, where they run two similar ads or headlines and put advertising money behind both of them and see which one's more successful or whatever. Well, like I guess for me, you could call it like healthcare, it's my like A/A/B test, where if the words affordable and or access are anywhere involved in your healthcare proposal or idea, then 99% of the time, it's bullshit.
That's true. Yeah. Yeah. That affordable. Yeah. I can't think of a, it's a way to say something without being clear on what you mean, which is usually a sign of deception.
Yeah. And the access one too. I don't think they have this in their guiding, principles here, but whenever you hear a politician say, we have to make sure everyone has access to healthcare, and you know, Bernie would say it great when he was on the campaign trail, where, what good's access? I have access to buy this car, but I don't have the money to buy it.
Right. Yeah. No, access, that's the you know, the law treats what's the line about The law makes it illegal to sleep under the bridge, no matter how much money you have. You know, obviously, right. An affluent person would never sleep under a bridge. But yeah, access is a bad word. Affordable.
Well, maybe if they bought the land under the bridge and developed it into a nice little under the bridge community with, you know, McMansions and such, maybe they would.
Yeah, I could see that. Turn the bridge into like the High Line or whatever. And it's really nice. Yeah, so that's affordable source of care is number one. And then number two, and this is the real puzzle, figure out how number two is different from number one. All Americans should be protected from financial devastation because of illness or injury. So one is affordable source of care. Two is protection from financial devastation that would result from buying care. So the only way these are two separate ideas is if it's possible for healthcare to be simultaneously affordable but also financially devastating.
I mean, maybe if you could buy it at Dollar Tree, that's their scenario, where like you could go to this, you know, who's going to be devastated by a dollar for a doctor visit, I guess. I mean, there probably are people, definitely are people who would be, but that's, I guess, their centrist view of it, that it's, you know, we have to find a way to, people have to have skin in the game, but not too much.
Yeah, but that would also be affordable. That's the problem. If it's affordable, it can't be financially devastating. But if, but then how are there two principles then? It's the same thing.
Right. Right. Or maybe they want it to be devastating, but not financially.
Yeah. Or maybe it would be financially devastating because, you know, you got like a really bad treatment and like then it really sidelined.
We want you to be able to afford the alleyway doctor over there who's going to accidentally amputate your leg when you're going for the flu shot. But he won't devastate you financially.
No. You'll be fine. You'll just be disabled for the rest of your life.
And then you brought up the third guideline already, which is put politics back in. Bring it back in. Let's get politics
back. Yeah, no, politics under healthcare under politics is principle three. So
now, thankfully, again, in the world we live in now, because of this conversation that these guys, the U.S. of Care, United States of Care, are late to, when they announced this stuff online, especially on Twitter, they received a ton of criticism. And one of those things, that one of the crazy things, is they're out there saying how, you know, we're going to find this great, affordable, no politics involved healthcare solution. And then they bring, apparently they don't have to bring him in because he's one of the founders of it, Bill Frist, a guy who had previously introduced a bill to privatize Medicare.
Yeah, well, you know, how else are you going to ensure long-term political support if you don't bring in Bill Frist? You know, he has his thumb on the pulse of the Republican position, so we got to make sure he's okay with the idea before we put it forward.
We want politics out of healthcare right after we use politics to privatize Medicare, but then after that, no more politics. Only corporations involved in your healthcare.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's absurd. I mean, the Bill Frist thing is a great that they put him on the board. Like, you kind of get the reasoning here, right?
They're
like,
well, what I read, he's a founder. Like, they didn't even decide to put him on the board. They decided to join him. Like, it's the opposite. It wasn't like they got together from what it sounds like and it was like, let's bring this guy on. It sounds like this guy was one of the guys who said, let's make this. And all the other people were like, oh, look, Bill Frist is involved. No problem. Let's do this.
Well, I didn't know that. I could see that. I don't even know what's going on. I don't know why. I could understand saying, oh, here we need a bipartisan plan that once it gets passed, the Republicans are not going to want to repeal it. So we need to get Bill Frist on board. And Bill Frist is like, yeah, we need to privatize Medicare. Actually, I want to like undercut the system we have right now. I want to go in the other direction entirely. And then you see that and you're like, okay, yeah, no, bipartisanship is not going to work here. And then the whole thing should fold. But instead, they bring him on. They know that he has no interest in any kind of universal healthcare plan that would actually work. And so the way they navigate that is by proposing these vague principles that amount to nothing and getting behind no policy substance whatsoever, because none of them could agree on policy substance. It reminds me of Brookings and AEI, of all people. They got together a couple of years ago to create a joint bipartisan, you know, strategy on poverty, and they end up producing this paper that is just complete garbage, just vague, just nonsense. And it's like, of course, you guys just, you're not going to agree on this. So instead of trying to do that, just get your side together, win, control the government, and put your stuff through.
Right. I mean, it's totally indicative of the entire centrist, the moderate position, where it's, you know, like, the middle ground is obviously take half of what the left says, half of what the right says, mash it together, and everyone's happy. But that's not the situation ever. Like, that's not what the middle ground is ever. Because you know, centrists look at it, like, I always look at it this way. Some people have been like, oh, it's too simplistic, whatever. But listen, if the left is saying this kills little to no people, and the right says this kills everybody. The middle ground should not be let's just kill a moderate amount of people. One side is right. You don't need to be the moderate position, the centrist position, to realize that one side can be right.
Right. Well, and also, I mean, just learning from the history of Obamacare, Obamacare was, you know, not in a, like, I'm just trying to be, you know, a leftist on this. That was the healthcare idea that was supposed to get support from Republicans and Democrats. It was Romney Care in Massachusetts. It is a very modest plan forward. We're not getting rid of private health insurance. We're using a private healthcare market to provide insurance to people on the exchanges. It has every kind of sop to the right wing that you could imagine. And that didn't protect it at all. Once the Republicans got in, they got rid of the individual mandate, and Trump is getting ready to allow these quote-unquote short-term health insurance plans, which is going to unravel the individual market even more. And it didn't work. It just didn't work at all. They didn't get a single Republican vote. So that's just not where we are. Cutting it down the middle doesn't ensure that your program is going to be more sustainable. It doesn't ensure that when the Republicans get in power, they're going to hold on to it because it was very reasonable and centrist. It doesn't do that.
Exactly. Well, because also Democrats are still to this day, at least I would say a majority of them, there are a few who've seen the light. They're still operating under the assumption that Republicans care about policy. It's unbelievable.
The biggest mistake Democrats make again and again is believing that Republicans are operating in good faith when they propose things. When they say, you know, for instance, that they don't care about the deficit, when the Democrats are supporting universal health care and they come out as they did with this Obamacare plan in the 90s, it was the Heritage Foundation plan, then the Romney Care plan. And what they do is they propose things, or the guns. Guns is the most recent example. We had this mass shooting in Parkland, and the Republicans are out here saying, oh, well, we need to maybe to have some better mental health screening, or maybe arm some guards and so on. All that is just there to distract you until the issue fades, and then they move on. They don't have any interest in doing any of that. They had no interest in this bipartisan solution to health care. No interest really in cutting the deficit, like they said before. No interest in moderate gun control. No interest in any of that. It's just there so they have something to say. Makes it seem like, you know, they're not just kind of defeatists. And then you go for it and you deal with them. And then at the end of the day, they, you know, loosey pulling the football up every time. Right. And Democrats just go for it over and over again.
Right. And I mean, it's a perfect example in this United States of Care debacle is there was an interview with Gregory Krieg of CNN that Andy Slavitt had. And this line that he says is just amazing when he's asked, you know, do you support Medicare for all? And he sort of tries to go around the question while finally getting to while finally giving an answer of, you know, personally, he supports it. And then he's asked, so why isn't it? Why doesn't this show in your actions, in your work? And he, Slavitt says, we have to use language that unites us all. You know, the word universal can be some people are so against universal that we can't say things like that. We can't advocate for universal healthcare because the Republicans might have a tantrum when they hear the word universal.
Yeah, no, that's that almost feeds back to the initial point about the popularity of Medicare for All, which is centrists also have a very confused notion of how ordinary people form policy preferences. It is not the case that there's a massive group of people in society who have very strong, like, clearly held positions on healthcare, such that if you use words like universal or whatever, that you're going to turn them off. That's not how it works at all. That's like how it works when you're navigating the power corridors of DC and you're going from think tank to think tank and congressional office to congressional office, there's a lot of these really hypersensitivities around how you frame it or whether the pay for is going to be a phase out or a surtax or blah, blah, blah. Normal people do not care about any of that. And what they need is some kind of clear, basic message that they can hook onto and get behind, and that they probably, you know, realistically are not even going to understand in its entirety, but that they kind of get the gist of, you know, like, oh, right. Medicare for all. Okay, yeah, it's like Medicare. I'll get a card and I'll go to the doctor and I'll show it to them, and that's that. That's all you need. And, right. And when you start getting into these nitty gritties of, well, are we going to use the word universal or not? You're in this insane focus group world that has no relationship to reality.
And to be clear, the average American shouldn't have to know all this wonkery and inside stuff. Like we a lot of people in politics really don't realize how much of a bubble they live in. I mean, you see it when they talk about, especially during elections, talking as if the average American is paying attention to the up to the minute, more so now with social media and the internet, this down to the second latest news and what this guy said and this guy said and this guy said and the always changing political world. You know, it's just not possible for someone who isn't making money in this world to pay attention to this and also have an outside industry job. Like, it's just not possible. And it's also why I think this, and you reminded me by bringing that up, you know, what really bothered me more so than Andy Slavitt, because again, the average American probably isn't really going to be too familiar with him, is the Pod Save America guys. I think like one or two of them came out as part of the board or supporters or whatever of this US of Care. Now, these are guys who are out there now as probably the breakout stars of the 2016 election. In terms of, every election, some company or media group ends up becoming like the de facto big winner of it. You know, like in 2008, it was Huffington Post. These guys have this huge podcast now, always one of the top podcasts on all of iTunes, probably hundreds of thousands, if not millions of downloads per episode. They have an HBO deal now to have their show live on HBO. For a few episodes during the summer, I think. And what are these guys thinking? I mean, I know they worked in the Obama administration, but they've totally been, promoting themselves at least as the face of the hashtag resistance. And they've been showing a little bit more of a left-leaning tendencies than they previously did. What is the play here from these guys?
I bet what happened here is, you know, Andy Slavitt emailed these guys. He probably already knows them. I'm sure they've met, and was like, hey, I'm launching this new organization. Would you mind giving me a tweet, brother? And they were like, sure, yeah, we'll support it. That's great. Healthcare. We love healthcare. And they just sort of put it out there and, you know, didn't think very much about it and just right. got, you know, I mean, I've had this. I have people send me stuff from time to time, ask me to tweet stuff because I've got a big following and whatnot. And, you know, I'll look at it, and if I like it, I'll tweet it. And if I don't, I won't. And I'm sure they got it. They probably didn't look that closely. They want to be friends with Andy Slavitt and all.
You're
these
about
other
to get a lot more DMs from me, man. I'll tell you that.
You know, if I like this episode, I'll retweet it. And that's how it'll go. So. I get that. I mean,
you might listen to this one and say to yourself, wow, this guest sucks.
Yeah, man, I did not do well. I have actually been on podcasts before and like was like, man, I didn't do that well. I'm not going to promote this one. But this one's been going well.
If you look at the terms of our agreement here, you have to, no matter what. I'm sorry, buddy.
Yeah, I'm trying. That is what I suspect happened just based on my own experience of how people approach you with right. these kind of things. And right. they didn't realize the buzzsaw that they're running into. And in many ways, you know, I think it was a great experience for them and for everyone involved to kind of realize, like, you know, yeah, you're going to get a lot of heat if you don't play this right. You know, we're not going to tolerate, oh, yeah, bipartisan solutions with Bill Frist. We're not going to tolerate. You can't just shove that down our throat anymore.
Right. And on a side note, I always have to bring this up when I talk about them in my, I don't know, personal conversations, but first time I think I'm bringing it up on the podcast here. Pod Save America, the name, doesn't even make any sense. No one says, it's a play on God Save America. No one says God Save America. It's God Save the Queen.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know how they came up with that. Did you see the, I don't remember the guy who actually tweeted this, but it's one of the best tweets of the year, I think, so far, which was the Pod Save America, no, Pod Damn America with Reverend Wright pick under it. I thought that was a great take on it. So
yeah, that's good. So lastly here, I want to get to this because I actually think, you know, if US of Care could be seen as, I guess, the bad news in terms of like, damn it, I thought we were done with this type of shit. I guess this can be considered, and it's not perfect yet, but it shows that we're getting in there, and that's the good news. And that's the Center for American Progress's newest healthcare proposal, which is, and I hate the name, Medicare Extra.
Yeah, Medicare Extra. It reminded me of Senator Michael Bennett's Medicare X, which was a completely different proposal, but actually sounds cooler.
Medicare Extra is actually the lowest tier in this plan. There's the middle level tier, which is the Medicare Extra Plus plan, and then there's the premium tier, which is the Medicare Extra Premium Plus plan. And then there's the enterprise plan, which is for Prime members only. You have to subscribe to Amazon Prime to get this plan.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And you get, it's all cloud-based and stuff. No, yeah.
But take us, because the name sucks, but I do think it's actually a step in the right direction for them.
Yeah, so Medicare Extra is very much like Pete Stark's AmeriCare proposal from many years ago, which I'm sure very few people are familiar with, but which has maintained a kind of cult following among certain single-payer wonks over the year and over the years. And the way that AmeriCare and Medicare Extra works, the idea is if we want to get everyone onto Medicare, we got to transition from where we are to there. And so how do we do that? And the idea is, okay, so let's look at our system right now. We got a lot of people are already on Medicare. Okay, cool. They're on board. You know, maybe we'll improve their benefits some. We got people on Medicaid. Let's just switch the Medicaid people over to Medicare. That's an easy move. And they're already on public insurance, not too hard. Then we got these people who are on these other public programs like the VA or Indian Health Service or TRICARE. For those people, you know, not very many people, a lot of them, they like their stuff, the VA people, the troops, they love VA. You know, the Native Americans, they like the Indian Health Service. They really like that stuff. It's already public. And in fact, even the hospitals are often public. So we'll just leave that how it is. But then comes the difficult question, which is we got, you know, 150 million people on employer insurance. We got another 12 million or so who have this individual insurance through the Obamacare exchanges. How are we going to get them onto Medicare? And the Medicare Extra answer and the AmeriCare answer is let's create a public option that goes into the employer market and goes into the individual market, and let's just get everyone to switch over. We can dominate those markets. Medicare is way more efficient than any private insurer. We've got a lot of power since it's the state behind it, where we can really coax almost everyone to switch over to Medicare because it's going to be cheaper, it's going to be easier, it's going to be great. And that's the basic idea behind Medicare Extra, is people who are already on a public program, let's switch them over onto Medicare, this new Medicare plan. And people who are on a private program, let's basically allow them to choose to switch over to Medicare Extra, a no-brainer choice that almost anyone's going to make because the premiums are going to be way lower, the service is going to be better, and the government can subsidize the price of the premiums as much as it wants and basically get everyone switched over like that.
So from the outset, it looks like, you know, a good proposal from the Center of American Progress.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a positive proposal. There are details that need to be hammered out or improved somewhat, but you know, this is if people who listen to the show know Tim Faust, this is similar to some of the stuff he's proposed. Mike Kongsel at the Roosevelt Institute has proposed something like this. John Walker, whose piece we talked about earlier, at PPP, the guy who wrote the second lowest cost sewer plan piece, that guy, he proposes a plan like this. So that's very much in the single payer mainstream and is not really that dissimilar from the kind of, I don't know, purest single payer schemes. The only way it differs is that it transitions people through this sort of public option mechanism, as opposed to transitioning them through, you know, say phasing them in by age, which is what Sanders proposes, where like in year one, everyone over 55 is on Medicare. In year two, everyone over 45 and so on. That's sort of how they phase it in. This one phases, this one phases it in through a different mechanism, but you know, it's all leading to the same eventual outcome.
Right. And just to sort of give everyone who may not be familiar with the Center of American Progress an idea of just how big of a move, I guess, this is to show people where this is really all going. Who exactly is the Center of American Progress, Matt?
Yeah, so the Center for American Progress is the, I would say, most powerful liberal think tank in D.C. Annual budgets, last time I checked on their 501c3, alone was $40 million, and they have a 501c4 as well that they don't report the revenue for. It was the Clinton think tank. It was the bench for Clinton. While we were waiting for Clinton to run in 2016, basically everyone who was going to serve in her administration sat at CAP and, you know, twiddled their thumbs waiting. And you know, it's sort of the core of the liberal establishment in D.C. And so to get them to this point, when you know that side of things was saying single payer will never happen, and you know all that kind of stuff, is a big move.
Right. They went from pie in the sky to maybe we can eat that pie.
Yeah, maybe we can do this. And what's funny is I remember during the primaries, you know, there wasn't a lot of support. There wasn't a lot of intellectual support behind single payer. Like, no think tanks had put out plans for single payer. Part of the reason why I wanted to People's Policy Project. But, you know, I would say during the primaries to podcast, you know, like I was on Slate's Gab Fest and they really pushed me on this, and I would talk to other journalists because I, you know, I was a Bernie guy and they would push me on this, and I would say, you know, to them every time, the reason the proposals don't exist is not because like it's a bad idea, it's just because the institutions that have all the money in DC to actually fund this kind of stuff, because it is very expensive to put together these proposals and do the modeling and all that, they just won't do it. That's the only problem we have. They could do it. If CAP wanted to, they could turn around tomorrow and in 2 months have a totally reasonable, viable single-payer plan. I tried to hit that over and over again. And I'm sure, you know, I was met with all sorts of eye-rolling and like, okay, yeah. And yet, you know, here we are.
Right. And there was something you kept pointing out to on Twitter, I remember, about this plan. Not to, you know, it's a good move from them. And it, like you mentioned, there's many people who are respected in this field who have put forth similar plans. But you kept bringing up this specific, line that they said about people choosing their company's health insurance.
Yeah. So one of the interesting things is the way the liberal pundits the consensus position among liberal pundits about why single payer is bad and can't work has become that you're forcing people off their employer health care. That's the thing over and over again. I have a great
piece that was it. Yes. Right.
People's Policy Project where I show Jonathan Chait says it, Paul Krugman says it. I've got, I don't know, 5 or 6 block quotes, and it's always done in like 2 or 3 sentences. There's no elaboration. There's no, you know, that just like everyone has agreed. The hive mind of the liberal pundit sphere has agreed that that's the main problem with single payers, that you're forcing people off their employer health care. Now, the secret with all liberal pundits, and really pundits in general, is they get their cues from other people. Very few of them are independent thinkers. That's why they all end up converging around the same ideas, the same talking points, which tend to come out of campaigns and consulting shops and whatever. And but that's where they've gone. That's how they decided to say, nope, I can't have single payer. So what was interesting when this plan came out from CAP, Medicare Extra, was to see how do they deal with the fact that this is a single-payer plan that is going to force people off their employer care. And the way that they dealt with it, or at least the way David Leonhardt at the New York Times dealt with it, was to say, no, this plan doesn't force people off their employer care. That's what makes it special. That's what makes it unique. That what makes it different from all these other single-payer plans. And you know, if you're kind of cynical like me, you're like, of course David Leonhardt reached this conclusion. Because one, he doesn't like the left and its single-payer positions. Two, he does like CAP and liberal establishment places. And so three, he's going to find some way to round that circle and say that CAP's plan doesn't force people off of insurers. And so, yay, now single-payer is good. And the left, they were still wrong all along. But we fixed their problems. And what I was pointing out on Twitter and pointing out on the post that I wrote about this at People's Policy Project is that this is just not true. That what's going to happen under Medicare Extra is that employers are going to go out and decide, you know what, instead of providing Blue Cross and Blue Shield or Aetna, I'm just going to provide Medicare Extra. I'm allowed to do that under this new scheme. I'm just going to provide that to my employees, and I'm going to force them to switch on to it. That's how it's going to work. That's how it's supposed to work, is that employers will force you over to Medicare Extra. That's going to be their new insurance offering. And liberal pundits, they're just ignoring this. And in some ways, it's kind of like, okay, whatever it takes. If this is how, you know, you got to save face going forward, is to be like, no, I was right all along. Single payer is bad because it forces people off of employer care. But this one, you see, it doesn't. If that's what it takes, then okay. But it's kind of absurd to have spent, you know, years arguing this point, and then the second a liberal establishment think tank endorses the idea, for them to just kind of wave their hands and pretend like that is not a problem anymore.
Right. It's up there with, you know, like the people who like their health insurance. Like, who are these people? Who are these people who have some sort of emotional attachment to their health insurance? I know nobody who likes their health insurance. And second of all, even to go further, this whole if you like your doctor thing that the right loves to harp on, I would say 99.9% of the people I know don't even like their doctor. I mean,
Well, right. Well, no, I think you make a really they try to play this game where they talk about people like their healthcare, but healthcare is not the same thing as insurance, right? Like,
right.
I like my doctor or the local hospital I go to. I personally don't care one way or another, but you might like that. But that's not the same thing as Aetna, Blue Cross Blue Shield. They're not the doctors. They just are basically an unnecessary middleman. No one cares about that. Oh, I love the place I send money to, who then sends money to the doctor. Like, well, I don't care. It's pointless. But then also the other point that I've been trying to make on this over and over again is that if you like your health care or you like your health insurance right now, you don't get to keep it. You lose it all the time.
Right.
People in a great study from the Bureau of Labor Statistics showed that between the age of 18 and 50, a normal worker, an average worker, has 11 jobs. So, yeah, you've lost your health care probably 11 times if you got it from your employer by the age of 50.
And that doesn't even account for how many times, and this happened to me, employers in the middle of you working there just change their health insurance company.
Right, at the same employer. You'll lose it when you lose your job or when you quit or go to another job. You'll lose it if your employer that year is like, oh, I found a cheaper plan. Everyone's got to be on this new plan. you lose it all the time. And so the idea that under the current scheme, they've just been having their health care forever. It's like an heirloom. It's just been in their family for decades and decades. No one's like that. People are bouncing around insurers all the time.
Right. All right, Matt, that was, I mean, I think we've really gotten down everything I wanted to talk about. And I think we did it in a way that made sure that the anti-single-payer people will have plenty of ammunition to... No, I think this was great. And I want to thank you so much for joining us. Matt Brunig of the People's Policy Project, and that's People's with an S, peoplespolicyproject.org. And you could follow Matt on Twitter, at Matt Brunig, where I will be DMing him nonstop to promote every single one of my podcast episodes, especially this one, though. And... I think that's that, Matt. Thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It was great.
When we all stand together, we're going to be able to take on the insurance companies and the drug companies and Wall Street and everybody else, and to do what we should have done decades ago, and finally guarantee health care to all Americans as a right.
I think Matt Brunig and I, the Matt Bees, if you will, really got into the wonkery of this all without any eyes glazing over, right? Eh? Well, I hope you enjoyed this episode of the show, and if you did, you should go to iTunes, you see where I'm going with this, and leave a 5-star review as well as a written review if you haven't already. It takes a second to press that little star button, maybe a minute if you're going to write a review. And reminder, if you enjoy the show and want to support an expanded future for it and can afford to do so, and as a thank you, get bonus content, go to Doom's brand new Patreon page located at legionofdoomed.com. And with that, see you all next time on Doomed.